Torah tonight because we were looking, although we're up to Perek Zayin Ches and Tes, but the Gra had referred to some sukkim that appeared later that we spent a few weeks on, actually, and that was the Pasuk Kiner Mitzvah, a very famous Pasuk. Kiner Mitzvah, this is, actually I'm not going to talk about that Pasuk, I'm going to talk about the next Pasuk, but that Pasuk of Ner Mitzvah, one second here. This was Chaf Beis Perek Hey. Actually, okay, it's a strange thing. Actually, it's not. Ner Mitzvah was earlier. That was in Perek Zion. But they're only going to explain the Pasuk in Perek Chaf Beis. It was a little odd. We were looking at the Pasuk in Perek Zion. Ki Ner Mitzvah v'Torah Or v'Derech Chayim Teichachas Musar. That's a Pasuk in Perek Zion. But the Vilna Gaon's explanation, strangely enough, is all the way in Perek Chaf Beis, Pasuk Hei. And the basic idea is Ki Ner Mitzvah. You don't even know how to translate it. Ki Ner Mitzvah. A mitzvah is like a candle that when I'm in the dark, I don't know where to go. A mitzvah gives me light. And the Torah is like an or. So we're going to have to differentiate between Ner and or. The Derech Chayim, and what is the pathway to life, is Tochachas Musar, is the rebuke of Musar. So the Vilna Gaon has a long, long Arichas there, and basically it's based on a Gemara. The Gemara says the following. This is a Gemara in Saita. Let me just find it again. Just 1 second here. Yeah, it's a beautiful Gemara, and the Gemara itself is obviously very rich. This is a Gemara in Saita on Chaf Aleph Amid Aleph. And I had gone over this, but I believe that nobody here was there at the time, so I can go over it again. The Gemara in Saita says, Es zu darash Rabbi Benachem Rav Yaisi, ki ner mitzvah v'tayra or, tala hakosa v'sa mitzvah b'ner. A mitzvah is compared to a candle. Torah is compared to the light of day. That means the natural light of the day. So he says the following. Mashal li'adam shaya mahalech v'ishin layla v'yafela. Let's imagine that a person is walking in the deepest darkness. Right? A person is walking totally in the dark. And he's afraid of a lot of things. U'misyorei min akaitzim. He is afraid of thorns. Right? He might bump into thorns or barbed wire. Min ha-bachasin, he's afraid of a pit. Right, you're walking in the dark, you don't know, you might fall into a pit. Min ha-barkanim, he's afraid of, again, barkanim are also a type of thorns. Umechayara, he's afraid of wild animals that might attack him. Umin ha-listim, and he's afraid of robbers. Right, so he has all of these fears in the dark. And finally, eini yodea b'eiza derech mahalach. He also doesn't know the way, because it's in the dark, he cannot tell. I don't know if you guys ever went there. I did not go there, but the JLE people go there sometimes. They ever go to the Museum of the Blind? Did you ever hear that? In Chalon, you know, near Tel Aviv, there's a museum. It's really a museum where you simply go through the museum, go through this whole exhibit being blind. It's led by a blind person. And it's like an hour. It's an hour of experiencing basically total blindness to see what it's like. And then, if you're in the mood for more of that, it's right next door to the Museum of the Deaf, which you go through the same. You go through the same thing. But people who have done this, I've never been there. They tell me it's an amazing experience just to understand what it's like. And then, of course, you have more Akaras HaTov. So, Rav Nachum Rav Yaisi is describing a person who is, because he's in total darkness, he's afraid of everything: thorns and pits and wild animals and robbers. And he doesn't know where to go. So step one is, nizdamno lo avuka shel or. He gets a torch. Now, when he gets a torch, that's going to save him from a lot of things, but not from everything. Nitzol min ha-kaitzim, min ha-bechasim, min ha-barkanim. He is now safe from thorns, pits, and again, thistles, because he could see. But there are two things he's still afraid of. He's afraid of wild animals, and he's afraid of robbers, because if anything, the light might attract them to him. And of course, the last thing is, even with the torch, he does not know Be'ezet Derech Mahalach. He doesn't know where to go. Now, once it's Amud HaShachar, that's the Or. Right? So the first step is the Ner. Then you have the Or, Amud HaShachar. So two things go away. The wild animals tend to be nocturnal. They tend to prey on people at night. And Hu Adin the Listim, most of the time criminals prey at night. So the Or saves him from Chaya Ra and Listim, but he still has the problem, even with the light of day, he does not know Be'eze Derech Mahalech. But then finally, he Gia L'Prashas Derachim. He reaches the fork of the road. Now, the fork of the road, well, you would think the fork of the road shouldn't really tell him which way to go. If anything, it makes it worse. But at a fork of the road, you usually have signs that tell a person this way, Tel Aviv, this way, whatever it is, Petach Tikva. So therefore, these are the three stages. Now, this needs a lot of explanation. What he's saying is the following. These are three levels of protection that a person is given when he's wandering around in the darkness. The first level of protection is the torch. And the torch will save him from Kotzim, Barkanim, and Pechasim. But he is still in danger of Chaya Ra, Listim, and doesn't know where to go. The second level is Or, dawn. And that's going to add to his protection. That's going to protect him from Listim and Chaya Ra. But he still doesn't know where to go. That is the third level of protection, Prashas Derachim, which tells him the Derech of life. So Rav Yaisi is trying to tell us, structurally, that is the progression of the three ideas in the pasuk. The mitzvah is like a torch, like a candle. The Torah is like the light of day. And the tochachas musar, the accepting the rebuke of musar, is the derech hachayim, is the road to life. That's the precious derachim that tells you where you need to go. In other words, he's taking this mashal and he's applying it to the three things in the pasuk. You see, and the Vilna Gaon has a long arichas, and he basically explains that these refers to different types of yetzer haras that a person has. Thorns, thistles, simply means a person is nichshol b'averus. In other words, he does averus even if they don't give him that much pleasure. He just falls into the habit by laziness or whatever. So by doing mitzvahs, a person develops certain qualities of zerizus and inner strength and discipline, and that'll protect him from the thorns and from the pits. But the chaya ra and the listim, that refers to midos within a person, such as anger. In other words, it refers to the wild animal within the person. Right? A person gets angry, a person is a bal gaiva. And there, mitzvahs may not help him. Mitzvahs may give him the discipline not to succumb to the lowest levels of Yetzer Hara, but it will not be misaken his midos of arrogance and gaiva. But there we say, Torah is like the light of the day that allows you to tame the animal that is within you. But there is still another problem. That is, even if a person has worked on his midos through Limud HaTorah, he still may not know his derech in life. Everybody has a unique derech. Everyone has a particular derech in Avodas Hashem. And a person may have all the good intentions, and a person may even have the good midos. But he hasn't really been able to clarify his derech in life. And that is where you need the guide of Musar, the guide of a Rebbe or a teacher that can be mochiach you. Not so much to give you... Now, there's Musar here isn't so much telling you all the things you do wrong, but it's to give a person hadracha, hashkafa, a way of approaching life. Because a person can be very well intentioned and you can spend many years learning. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, your neshama is filled with Torah, but you may not necessarily, all of us may not necessarily know the proper derech in life. Should I work? Should I learn? Should I go to college? You know, should I go to America? Stay in Eretz Yisrael? Life is filled with all of these unknown questions. And for that we need tochachas musar, meaning to say a Rebbe, a Madrich, a person that could give us a hashkafa. So that's the thing. Mitzvos give us the basic discipline that we don't succumb to the thorns. We don't simply get into the mud, the dirt, the pit. Torah can elevate us in terms of teaching us humility and submission to Hashem. That's misaking the midos of gaiva and kas. And then finally, tochachas musar is the precious drachin, the fork in the road, that shows you the eza derech mahalach, right? And that's the pshat of Rav Nachum Breg Yossi. Now, I'll just make a little ha'ara that it seems to me, and you have to be ma'ayin, it seems to me that this thought of the Gra is a little contradictory to another thought that the Gra expressed. A very, very famous thought. And it was something I sometimes say. I said it at a mentor's mission, Shabbaton. And I've never said it since then because the guy from Lakewood was so angry at me that I decided I'm not going to say it in front of the mentors anymore, because he denied that the Gra could have said it, although the Gra does say it. I can show you where he said it. And this is what the Gra says. This is quite an amazing thought. All of us know the idea that Torah is compared to water. Torah is compared to water. And Torah is compared to water so many reasons. Just like water purifies you, Torah purifies you. Just like water is necessary for life, Torah is necessary for life. Just like water goes from high to low, the Torah leaves the arrogant and goes to the humble. Many, many reasons why Torah is compared to water. But the Gra says an amazing thing. Really, really amazing. The Gra says, Torah is compared to water because it is the nature of water that whatever you pour it on is going to grow. Meaning water is what is called a koach that's matzmiach. Now, what does that mean? And the water is indifferent if what it causes to grow is a good thing or a bad thing. If I pour water on ground, if there are wheat seeds, I'll get wheat. If there are poisonous weeds, I will get poisonous weeds. Water causes whatever is there to grow and flourish, whether what is there is good or bad. Water does not only water that which is good, water waters that which is bad. So this is what the Gra says. The Gra says that Torah is compared to water because whatever is in you, Torah is going to intensify and strengthen. What does that mean? A person has midos tovos. A person is a rachaman. A person is compassionate. A person is kind. A person is loving. A person is giving. Torah is going to make a person better in those ways. That's partial, right? That's not exceptional. But the chiddush is, if a person is a baal gaiva, a baal kas, then the Torah that he learns might actually make him worse. This is where the Likudite didn't believe. And that's why the Gra says, a person has to consciously work on his midos. A person cannot just assume that the Torah itself will take care of it. Because if anything, the Torah can make a person worse. Now, on some level, we can understand this. Let's say a person is a baal gaiva, a person is very competitive. Yeah. Obviously, limud ha-Torah can obviously be an avenue where competitiveness comes out. Right? A person who's competitive in business can now become cutthroat, you know, slugging people up and showing how they're wrong and showing how he's better than them and everything else. And the process of learning Torah is not automatically going to improve. Now, the problem is this. Now, first of all, you cannot accuse, nobody can accuse the Vilna Gaon of not being machshav limud ha-Torah, right? Yes, so that's the meaning of Sam Amavas. That's exactly right. That if a person learns without midos togos, the Torah could actually become poisonous to him. Now, the Emma says nobody could accuse. Yeah?
In that case, changing midos is more important than learning Torah, and changing midos is the most important thing.
That's correct. That's the foundation, meaning to say Torah cannot penetrate a person whose midos are not good. It's like a wall. It's a barrier. The Rambam calls it a mechitza, a rock wall between you and Hashem, between you and Hashem's Torah. Now, you know, if this would have been said, let's say, by the Baal Shem Tov or something, you know, we would have said, all right, the Hasidus emphasized, you know, other types of service of Hashem besides Torah learning. But this is said by the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, nobody could possibly say the Vilna Gaon was not Machshev Limud HaTorah. The Vilna Gaon, as we know, for most of his life, learnt between 20 and 22 hours a day. The Vilna Gaon, not for all of his life, because he was older too, but the Vilna Gaon only slept 2 hours a night for a lot of his life. And even that was only in 4 half-an-hour segments. He never slept more than a half an hour at a time. And his whole life was Limud HaTorah. I mean, he measured his Bittul Torah in minutes per year. And what did he call Bittul Torah, by the way? Bittul Torah didn't mean, what he called Bittul Torah, we would probably call Limud HaTorah, but whatever it was, he had to answer some shilas that he held that were not so significant. And the like. In fact, there's a story about the Vilna Gaon that he once went to a chasna. He didn't go to too many chasnas either, but he once went to a chasna in a certain city. And by this time, he was already very, very famous, very, very well known. And when he went to a city, it was a big, big deal. And he had a room, and he was learning all night. And it was like the second story of a house. And people of the town would take turns on a ladder just to go and watch him. Climb on a ladder to just look into the window to see him learn, and every person was allowed to watch him for a minute, and then you'd have to get down, and somebody else watched him. It was a whole big thing. And they saw the Vilna Gaon, they actually saw the Vilna Gaon sleep as well, and he slept, and apparently he slept for 40 minutes instead of 30 minutes. And they saw him. He didn't know he was being watched, and they saw him. And when he woke up, he started crying. He says, "Oy veis mir, 10 minutes of Torah, 10 minutes of Torah." He says, "This city is a sleeping city. It makes me sleep. It makes me sleep. How can I be in such a city? It takes me away from Torah." So it's recorded that the whole town was heartbroken. The whole town was like heartbroken, sabrakan, that they were goyrim, 10 minutes of Bittul Torah to the Vilna Gaon. Anyway, something like 5 years later, he had to be in the same city for something. And he only slept for 20 minutes. So he said to himself, he says, "Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the opportunity to make up the 10 minutes that I missed." And the whole city was Mesameach. We gave the Vilna Gaon back his 10 minutes. So the point is that the Vilna Gaon, for sure, in a way that we don't even understand today, you know, it's hard for us to understand this, you know. Not that I was close to him. I mean, I knew Rebbe Yosef. I saw Rebbe Yosef. And it's hard for us, I think, to imagine, well, did the Vilna Gaon like learn more than Rebbe Yosef? Like, you know, Rebbe Yosef learned like every possible moment. Rebbe Yosef slept a little more, but okay. And yet, apparently, we understand, or in fact, Rebbe Yosef said, that there were Gedolim in his lifetime who were bigger Masmidim than him, although it's hard for me to imagine. His uncle was Rav Pesach Tzvi Frank. And he said that Rebbe Yosef said on himself, that he was nothing compared to Rav Pesach Tzvi Frank. I mean, so it's hard for me to imagine. Rav Pesach Tzvi Frank was a great gadol. It's hard for me to imagine, like, you know, how could Rav Yosef be nothing compared to Rav Pesach Tzvi Frank in terms of hasmada? But be it as it may, so the chiddush is, it's a tremendous chiddush, is it not, that the Vilna Gaon himself would say that without tikkun hamidos, the Torah can actually make a person worse. And that is why they say that in an indirect way, the Vilna Gaon is actually the founder of what is called the Musar movement. Now, we know the Musar movement, which was a movement in Europe that was designed to emphasize working on your midos, particularly Bein Adam L'Chaveira, and the founder of what was called the Musar movement, or the Tznuas HaMusar, was Rav Yisrael Salanter in the middle of the 1800s, the middle of the 19th century. But remember, you have to keep in mind the lineage here. Rav Yisrael Salanter was inspired. Rav Yisrael Salanter was a brilliant Eloi, but he was inspired to work on these Inyanim of Midos and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro by his Rebbe, who was a hidden Sadik. And this was his hidden Rebbe, Rav Zundel Misalant, who was actually a businessman. Rav Zundel Misalant did not have a yeshiva, did not have Talmidim, But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter decided to follow him around all the time because he had a sense that he was a hidden tzaddik, and he would watch him. And Rav Zendel did all sorts of hidden things, hidden learning, hidden tefillas, hidden chasadim. And Rav Zendel Salanter was like a spy. As a teenager, he would like follow him around, and he would be watching him all the time to see what Rav Zendel would be doing. And one time Rav Zendel caught him, and Rav Zendel said to him, Yisrael, if you want to be a Yirei Shemayim, the Mesila Shesharim should be your guide. And be as it may, he says that type of encounter made Rav Zendel Salanter devote his life to Musar. But Rav Zendel Misalant, although he was a Nister, he was a very hidden person, he was a great Talmud of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. And Rav Chaim Volozhiner was, of course, the Talmud Muvak of the Vilna Gaon. So in many ways, the whole Indian of Musar and Tikkun HaMidos comes down from the Vilna Gaon to Rav Yisrael Salanter. And by the way, what Musar meant in Europe is not really the way it's done today, although in some circles it's done. The Musar movement, the Musar yeshiva in Europe, was not just you learned a Musar sefer for 10 minutes a day. The sefer was an important thing, but Rav Yisrael Salanter envisioned there would be something called a base Musar, a separate house, a separate base medrash of Musar, where people would come in, and they would not just, in fact, Rav Yisrael Salanter said, you have to learn Musar in two ways. There is the intellectual learning of Musar, in which you look at Svarim, like Chavos HaLevavos, Mesila Shesharim, you try to understand their philosophies, you try to understand human psychology, because a lot of Musar is understanding your own psychological processes, but that's an intellectual endeavor. In fact, it's a very difficult intellectual endeavor to understand my midos. Why do I behave a certain way? It really is a form of spiritual psychoanalysis. But then Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said there was another mahalach of Musar, which was called Musar behispilus. Hispilus means with emotional fervor, emotional excitement, where you would try to bring out certain strong emotions and feelings by sometimes, like a mantra, by sometimes taking one maimer chazal, one sentence, and saying it over 300 times till it penetrated you emotionally. Like whatever it would be. It says that sometimes it might be a morose thing that, you know, the end of a person is rima v'soleya, is like a worm, we're going to die and be nothing. Other times you would talk about the greatness of Torah learning, whatever it would be, but some one maimer that you would just say over and over and over again. Again, there are a lot of overlaps with certain types of Hasidus, with Hespodidus and the like. It's interesting to compare the two. So Rav Yisrael Salanter envisions both intellectual Musar and Musar v'hispailus. But most importantly, Rav Yisrael Salanter said, this would have to be a group endeavor. And this is where you get what is called a Musar Vad. A Musar Vad just means a group of people, would actually be that Chaverim would get together. Now, it might just be two people. Two people is enough to be a Vad, or it might be more than two people. And literally, they would discuss, it's a very deep level of friendship, that most of us are not able to handle that type of deep level of friendship, in which my job would be to tell you all of the things you need to work on, and your job would be to tell me all the things I need to work on. We would look at each other and we would try to help each other become better, Ovdei Hashem, to be Mesaket Midos. So what happened was that there were yeshivas that were against this idea of Musar. In fact, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was against a Musar movement. He wasn't against Midos. What does it mean to be against Musar, right? Obviously not against Musar, but he was against the notion of this psychoanalytical thing and the Musar behispilus and the Vadim. He held it to his Bittul Torah, and it was Rav Chaim Shita that Torah alone, the Brisker Shita still is, that Torah alone is going to be misaking you. Torah alone is going to give you good meters. Now what's interesting is, the Vilna Gaon himself seems to disagree. So Brisk, to this very day, does not have a concept of a Musar Seder. Again, that doesn't mean they don't learn Musar Svarim, of course they do. But you don't make a special thing. In fact, I think they say B'Shem Rav Chaim, kind of even a joke. It says in Hallel like this, Beis Aron, Bitchu Bashem, right? The house of Aaron should trust in Hashem. Those are Kohanim. Beis HaLevi Baruch Hu Hashem. The house of Levi. Then it says, Yirei Hashem, and those who fear Hashem. Now, why doesn't it say, Beis Yirei Hashem? So Rav Chaim said, you see, you don't need a house for Yirei Shemayim. You don't need a Beis. A Beis Musar you don't need. You're a Yirei Hashem, wherever you are, Yirei Hashem. Beis, you have to have a Beis Musar and the like. So the truth of the matter is, we don't realize that at a certain point, this was a fairly big, big machlokas among a number of yeshivas. We saw Solanter, the altar of Slobodka, the altar of Kelim. They started Musar yeshivas. And people like Rav Chaim did not like the Musar yeshivas. And this became a big machlokas, not kidei kach, that when Musar was introduced in some yeshivas, some of the Chashuv of Bachrim revolted. Tells, which was a non-Musar yeshiva, Rav Leib Chassman was, Eliezer Gordon, who was the founder of the Tells yeshiva, hired Rav Leib Chassman to be a Musar mashgiach. And the Bachrim, some of the Chashuv of Bachrim didn't like it. And there are stories that Rav Leib Chassman, who was a big Talmud Chacham in his own right, was tarred and feathered. He was like carried out of the yeshiva in the middle of the night. Now, if anything, that might be a raya that you did need Musar in and of itself. But that was the thing. It was a very big machlekes. In fact, there was a machaber of Dov Katz who wrote five volumes on the personalities of Tznuas HaMusar. We saw Solanter, the Altar of Kelim, the Altar of Nevada, the Altar of Slobodka, all of their different views, their different approaches. Very, very interesting. The different shitas. He included the Chavetz Chaim, although the Chavetz Chaim was technically not part of the Musar movement, although he talked about Tikkun HaMidos. But there was a sixth volume that he published separately that was called Pulmas HaMusar, all of the fights against Musar. And that he didn't, he wasn't mefarsim it so much, because some of it involved Lashon Hara, but on the other hand, it was important to know what was going on. So I still remember when I was in yeshiva, we really were looking for that volume, because that had all of the juicy gossip and the interesting stories, and I wanted to get a hold of that. Pulmas HaMusar. So it was a very, very big fight. Now, the Chafetz Chaim, which is already later, a little later, was Machriya, and the Chafetz Chaim basically said, this was his answer. His answer was that Torah is the diet for a healthy soul. When your soul is healthy and good, so Torah is your diet, and that's all you need. But when you have a sickness of the soul, the same way a sick person could not just eat a regular diet, he would have to supplement it with medicine, so too, we have sick souls. We have so many Yetzer Haras. We need the medicine of Musar to try to be Masakin. So the truth of the matter is that although most yeshivas today are Musar yeshivas in name, but not really in practice. You know, the Musar, they have a little Musar Seder, whatever it is. The exception was Revolver Zatzal tried to create, he did create a base Musar. And you'll find in some places Musar Vadim. Often women do it, but whatever it is. But I mean, women have Musar Vadim and the like. But it's really a tremendous, tremendous idea that Chaverim, we are Mechazik each other by giving us ways that we can grow in Avodas Hashem. But it comes from love. It doesn't come from negativity. Meaning to say, the concept is not, oh, I'm going to tell you what a rotten guy you are. I mean, that would be stupid. I mean, that would make no sense. It comes out of the deep love that Chaverim have for each other, in which they actually welcome hearing how they could be better. Like, please tell me how I can be better. And then you think about the other person and you help them. Again, it doesn't have to be a large group. As I say, a group of two is also good. And the Rambam, in fact, says that that is the deepest level of friendship. Pirkei Avos tells us, Kinei lecha chaver. Get for yourself a friend. Kinei lecha chaver. So the Rambam says, why do you need friends? Why are friends important? So the Rambam says, there are three reasons why friends are important. Three reasons. Reason number one, we can call utilitarian or practical. What does that mean? You know, let's say I'm on the road, I lost my keys, I lost my car keys, I lost my key to my apartment. If I don't have a friend, like who do I call when I'm in trouble? So you need a friend because sometimes you're in trouble. Oh, thank you, thank you. So that's, we'll call that the practical need of friendship. Then there's a second reason. We're lonely. You know, man, people are social usually, and, you know, it's good to have somebody to talk to. That's also an inyan. But the Rambam says there's a third reason for friendship, and that is so that my chaver can help me grow spiritually, and I can help him grow spiritually. As the Pasuk says, the Navi says, Ish esreyeyu yazayru uliachiv yaymar chazak. It's even an Avram Fried Nigan. Ish esreyeyu yazayru. One person helps his friend and says to his brother, chazak, be strong. Shlomo HaMelech says, Tovim hashnayim min ha'echad. Two are better than one. Because if one person falls, who will pick him up? When there are two people and one falls, the other can pick him up. And all the Midrashim say that this is not just a reference to physical falling, but in our ruchnius life, there are going to be times of when we're standing tall, and there are times that we fall and we slip, and we're not successful. And chaverim may have different up times and different down times. So if both people are down, then it's a little difficult. That happens sometimes. But often, when one is down, the other is up, and therefore he can pick him up. Right? This was the idea of a Musar Vad. But again, as I say, things don't have to be all or nothing, even if you don't have an official Vad. The concept of a chaver, the Rambam says, is someone to give chizuk. By the way, let me just digress for a moment, because maybe it's interesting to talk about a little bit. I had mentioned that Rav Yisrael Sulanter was the founder of what's called the Tznuas HaMusar. And the Tznuas HaMusar did spread through most of the yeshivas of Europe. Not all. Brisk, for example, still was misnagged to the Shita of Musar. But what's interesting is Yisrael Sulanter had many, many different talmidim. And he was an amazingly interesting person in so many ways. In fact, to this day, there is no picture of Yisrael Sulanter that I'm aware that exists. We really don't know what he looks like. Now, I did see once there was a picture of his grandson and who was when he was older, and somebody wrote on the picture that the grandson looked like the grandfather. So, Epshir, in that way, we have an indirect way of... In fact, there are two Gedolim who are, you know, after the age of photography that we don't know how they look like at all. One is Rav Yisrael Sulanter, and the other is the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shmuel, whatever, at least for some reason. Although Chabad has gazillions of pictures of everybody, they have no picture of the fourth Rebbe. It's not clear why. There's a bit of a rumor that he died young and he was very, very ill, so they think that he didn't look well, so they didn't want to show a picture, who knows. But be it as it may, but Rav Yisrael Sulanter, there's no picture. But he was very interesting. He was a Gadol B'Torah. He grew up in Lita, around Vilna. And his main great Talmidim were Vilna. But in his 50s, he left Vilna, and he wandered in all sorts of strange places. He spent a lot of his life in France and Germany, where there were virtually no religious Jews at all. Germany was totally taken over by the Reform movement. And France also had very, very few Jews, and certainly the Jews that were religious were not B'nai Torah, they were not Talmidei Chachamim. But he was involved in Kiruv Rechaikim. Imagine, it's very unusual, because he was a Gadol Hador, and yet he was involved in teaching people Aleph Beis, he was involved in teaching them, I mean, obviously when he taught, he was teaching deep ideas, but he was teaching people very, very, very below his level, meaning in Vilna, he had Talmidim who themselves were Gadol Hador. But he spent years and years, decades of his life with Amoratsim, with people who were not religious. He used to go in Germany, one of the main ports on the North Sea is Königsberg, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And just like in Salonika, all of the longshoremen were Jews. Although it's interesting, Salonika, the Svartische longshoremen were Shomer Shabbos. So Salonika was the only port in Europe that was closed on Saturday, which is a busy day in the port. But in Königsberg, unfortunately, the port was open on Saturday, even though all the longshoremen were Jewish. You know, they were Mechalel Shabbos. He spent time teaching the longshoremen how to do their malachas with the shinui So at least he could knock it down from an Isser D'Oraisa to an Isser D'Rabbanan. Because he felt that that was a sechus. He spent time convincing people who were eating chazer that they should eat nevela instead of chazer, that a cow that's not shechted is not as big a sin as a behemoth tzemeah, etc., and the like. So he spent a lot of his life with people who were not on a high madrega spiritually. He did kirov on college campuses in those days, the universities. He was involved in projects to translate the Gemara into German. Some of them didn't go very far, but he started doing those things and the like. So every 8 months or so, he would go back to Vilna to kind of recharge himself, to be with his Talmidim and be in a more Torah-dika society. And then he'd go back to France and Germany. And he went, back when he spent many, many years that way. It's interesting, by the way, there's also recorded that he suffered from depression. There were times in his life that he literally had what we would call a diagnosis of depression. And yet, he held, you have to be miskaper over everything. A person has avodas Hashem, and he did what he did, and he did what he did, no matter what, he may have been feeling in any particular way. And then depression, by the way, was described as fairly severe sometimes. And yet, he persevered. The story goes that he died in Paris, and he was poverty-stricken. He had no property at all, except his talus was the only thing that he had. And he was dorming, so to speak, with an old man. And he saw that the old man was very afraid to be with a mace. So they say the last moments of Rizal Salanter's life, he spent comforting the old man just to tell him, a body is just a body, nothing to be scared of, there are no shade of it. You'd think such a tzaddik, his last moments, he'd want to, do tshuva or think about lofty thoughts. But he held that the chesed he could do for this person that's frightened was shakol, connected anything. And there are so many stories. Again, basically, there are gazillions of stories of Rabbi Saul Salanter's midos. The story goes, in Tznuas HaMusar, you have 500 pages of all sorts of maisim and stories and the like. But one story that's interesting is that because he was poor, because he was always wandering away from his home, because he did have a wife and children, but he very rarely saw them, he depended on people's hospitality. And the story goes that once a person who was a Ben Taira in Germany invited him to his house, and the person said, "Oh, my Baruch Hashem, I'm Zeichet, have a very wonderful Shabbos Suda that we have Zemiros between courses, and then we have Divrei Torah between courses, and the Suda lasts for 5 or 6 hours, just the Valdiga Suda, and with the Rebbe there, it's going to be tremendous." So Saul Salanter said, "I'm going to go to your house on the condition that you finish the whole suda in 40 minutes. No zmiros, no divrei Torah. We just wash, we eat, we bench." So the person said, "But, Rebbe, that's my condition. Otherwise, I can't go." So he goes there, and the man is really so disappointed. He thought he'd have his whole salatra. No divrei Torah. They bench, they eat, they clear the dishes. Finished. Rabbi Saul Salanter then says, "Can I talk to the cook?" Because this was a rich man who had a woman who was cooking in the kitchen. And Rabbi Saul Salanter said to the cook, "I want to apologize for rushing you. I'm sorry if this was so fast." And the cook said, "Rebbe, this was the greatest Shabbos I've ever had. I have a family, I have a child, and normally I come home like 2 o'clock in the morning and I spend a little time with my son. And this is the first time in 5 years I've been able to get home at a decent hour and spend time with my child." And Rachel Sandra told the person, "Here you learn a lesson. You don't be a tzaddik," the famous words, "you don't be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. You want to be a tzaddik, but look at who you're inconveniencing. Look at the trouble you're causing somebody else. You don't be a tzaddik when you're inconveniencing somebody else." And that was one of Rachel Sandra's great teachings. Did you want to say something? You had your hand up. Okay, if you come to you later. But anyway, what I want to tell you is that Rabbi Saul Salanter had many Talmidim, but three of his Talmidim developed very distinct approaches to Musar, and it's very, very kedai to be aware of this, that sometimes the greatness of a Rebbe is that he doesn't make cookie-cutter imitations of himself, but each person takes a certain facet of the Rebbe's Shita and develops it. Rav Chaim was that way in learning. You know, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Talmidim, Rav Shimon, Rav Baruch Be'er, Rav Ochanan, they all had very, very different, Rav Isser Zalman, they all had very, very different drachim in learning. It's not like today where if you're a brisker, you know, you got to follow, you know, something 100% exactly the same. Rav Chaim himself, all of his Talmidim were very, very different in that way. So Rav Soloveitchik's three main Talmidim both go by the appellation altar, the old man. There is the altar of Kelim. Kelim is a city in Lithuania. That's Rev Simcha Zissel Brody. The other is the altar of Slobodka, Rev Nosson Svi Finkel, who is the great-grandfather of the Mira Rosh Hashiva, who bore the same name. And the third was the altar of Navardik, Rev Yosef Yezel Horvitz. Now, of the three Talmidim, the altar of Kelim was the senior and was probably the closest to Rabbi Israel. And let me just explain what the altar of Kelim was. The altar of Kelim was known as being an extremely organized person. The essence of his teaching was a human being has to cultivate self-control, discipline, and serenity, no matter, yishuv hadas, no matter what's going on in your life, that you have to develop a calmness, that things don't upset you, and you proceed with what you have to do. So he started a yeshiva in Kelim, and people don't realize this, that Kelim was actually a yeshiva for high school age kids. You could stay afterwards. In other words, it actually was what we would call in Eretz Yisrael a yeshiva katana. People, you know, kids came in when they were 13 or 14, and he wanted to take them young because he wanted to train them in certain midos. And the whole thing about Kelim was to learn to control yourself. You don't have to be a creature of your moods or your desires at any given time. And because of this, he had all sorts of exercises that might sound a little crazy, but they were part of the character building. For example, if you got a package from home, which in Lithuania was a big deal, just a little bit of food at home, you could not open it up for 24 hours, or a letter from home. Because, you know, what a person normally wants to, you know, rip it open. No, you wait 20, put it away, you see it on your dresser, you don't touch it for 24 hours. That was the idea. And then you had to share with other people. After a fast, the minhag in Kelim was, they would serve fish with small bones. Bony fish. Why? Because after a fast, a person eats fast. Wanted to force you. Eat slowly. In Kelim, if there was a loud noise, they even had people like Gaboyim, that if you looked around in davening, if somebody came in, you wanted to see who was there, you know, you'd have to pay a knas. And if there was a loud noise or something, you looked around. So Yaakov Kamenetsky, as a young boy, went to tell him, and he used to tell the story that his first day in Kelim, it was a Kriyas HaTorah day. And there was no Kohen, so they were going to call Yisrael from Kohen. But Rav Yaakov noticed a Kohen just walked in, so he told the Gabbai, oh, a Kohen just walked in. So the Gabbai said, thank you for telling me, but that'll be 5 rubles or whatever it is, because you're not supposed to be looking who walks into the place. Anyway, Rav Yaakov said later about Kelim, he says, every person should spend 6 months in a place like that. But then he said, but maybe no more. He said, it was a good type of chinuch. Rav Dessler is already the second generation. Rav Dessler was a Talmud of Kelim. Rav Dessler came from Kelim. Many of the great Balmas, Rav Elio Lapian, if you heard of these names, these were Talmidim of Kelim. Most of them died in the Holocaust. Most of them died in the... I mean, Rav Simcha Zissel himself was nifter like 1898, but he continued for a few generations until the Holocaust. So the whole idea of Kelim was organization, introspection, calmness, not getting upset. In fact, Rav Simcha Zissel once told a mother, once went to him and complained. She was from a wealthy family, and said, you know, why can't I send my son good food and everything else? Like, why are you so Spartan here? So he said, an interesting thing, he said, he didn't give her a whole mussar about taiva. He said something else. He said, if you could promise me that your son will always have this standard of living, I would say go ahead. But you know, life has its ups and downs. And if he doesn't learn how to handle life, even without all the luxuries, then he's going to be broken. It's a very different, in other words, it wasn't just a frum thing about being Shaver Tiger. He was looking at it as a way of building a capacity to respond to life in different ways. It's a more deeper way of understanding it. That a person has to learn not to be overly connected to the Gashmias of Olam Hazeh, simply because you don't always have it. And you'll just not be able to serve Hashem otherwise. So we have many, many Edei Re'iyah that at the Holocaust in Kelim, when the Nazis massacred many of the Talmidim, how they went to their death with such calmness. And that always psyched out the Nazis, by the way, because one of the things that gave the Nazis perverse pleasure was when Jews would beg, you know, beg, please, you know, begging never helped, obviously. But, you know, they would beg, they would fall apart, they would be like, you know, animals, frightened animals. And here were people who went with dignity, calmness. They understood. They lived their lives, Al Kiddush Hashem, and now they're going to give their lives, Al Kiddush Hashem. It's part of their avoda, and part of their avoda is to never let the Tzelem Elokim be tarnished. And, you know, it's really, I mean, again, not that it makes a big difference, but the Nazis didn't know what to do with that. And they, you know, they were reluctant to even shoot. I mean, you know, the German sense of duty eventually overpowered them. But the Nazis were literally, they were in awe over the fact that a human being could have so much control over themselves that even in the moment of these deaths, and Rav Dessler writes, the Michta Melev, because these were Rav Dessler's Chaveirim and his Rebbeim, and he recounts in the Michta Melev the Eidus of how they went to the death, but he made the point that you're able to die that way only because you learn to live that certain way. Another example of Kelm that's very, very famous, Rabbi Yashiv used to mention this, and that is there was a mandatory Seder in the middle of the night for 5 minutes. No more. 5 minutes. What was the idea? In other words, you would be woken up, let's say, 15 minutes before the Seder. You'd have 10 minutes to get ready. You'd have to learn for 5 minutes and then go back to sleep. That was designed to teach you the importance of time. Because when you have a 5-hour Seder, all right, so if I'm 10 minutes late, what's the big deal? When you have a 5-minute Seder, you can't really be too late. So the notion was how every minute counts. Rabbi Yashiv used to say this a lot because he was that way himself. For many, many years, when he was able to walk, he did not learn at home. He learned in a shul in Mea Sharim called Ohel Sara. And he locked himself into the shul. It was like an abandoned shul, and it's still there. He had the key, and even if, you know, people had to ask him shilas, he was very, in that way, people would like bang on the window sometimes, and they would yell, Pikuach Nefesh, and, you know, he would not answer the door. Later, when somebody, the guy who was banging and saying Pikuach Nefesh, went to him during his open hours for shilas and shuvas, the person apologized. And Rabbi Yashiv says, oh, you were the guy that was banging. He says, tell me, am I an ambulance? Am I a doctor? If it's Bikuach Nefesh, you go to a doctor. What are you going to me? If something's a matter of life and death, I mean, it wasn't even Shabbos, so just take care of it, you know, whatever. He says, I'm not an ambulance, you know. Okay, you could raise questions about that, but putting that aside, that he would, let's say, if he went home for a mincha or something like that, or for a bris, and then his question and answer thing, his Kabbalah's call, would be 15 minutes later, he would walk back to Ohel Sara to learn. Now, it took him 5 minutes there. For whatever reason, he didn't want to learn at home because there would be distractions. So he actually would walk 5 minutes back, learn 5 minutes, and then walk 5 minutes back. And he says, for the 5 minutes Seder, and he would tell people, don't you remember, and tell them they had a 5 minute Seder. So that's kind of the way he was. So this is the altar of Kelim. The altar of Kelim was serenity, orderliness, self-control, not giving into emotion, kind of being in control of yourself all the time. Now, the second great Talmud was the altar of Slobodka. Now, the altar of Slobodka was younger than Rav Simcha Zissel, and in fact, the emes is, the altar of Slobodka met Rav Yisrael towards the end of Rav Yisrael's life, but the altar of Slobodka was actually more of a Talmud of the altar of Kelim. And in fact, even when the altar of Slobodka was the head of Slobodka, he used to go to Kelim for Elul and Yomim Narayim. And yet, he developed a very, very different shita, and they got into a lot of disagreements. The altar of Kelim, altar of Slobodka, loved each other very dearly, but they had a great, great shita. In fact, my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ruderman, who was very close to the altar of Slobodka, used to describe, I don't know, I guess the altar told him, that the harsh, that if he would have spoken to any Talmud in Israel, the way the altar of Kelim gave mustard to the altar of Slobodka, says he wouldn't have a yeshiva every single Talmud. Please. I mean, the altar of Kelim would, you know, hit him in so many ways. But the altar of Slobodka developed a different shita. And the altar of Slobodka's shita, as exemplified in his yeshiva, Slobodka, was to emphasize the greatness of a person. That instead of a mussar that talked about, oh, you have this wrong and this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, in which you become so hyper aware of all of your flaws, the altar of Slobodka saw that in our generation, you need to emphasize the potential of a person, the godless of a person. And he would talk over and over again about how great a human being is and the nobility of a person. And the concept would be, how could you besmirch yourself? How could you lower yourself when you have so much potential, so much greatness? So in Slobodka, the emphasis was godless Adam. And because of that, the altar of Slobodka very much emphasized individuality. Unlike Kelim, which was kind of trying to create a mold of a personality where everybody behaved in a consistent way, Slobodka was a much more freewheeling yeshiva, in which different people developed in different ways. Now, interestingly enough, that has a big benefit, and that has a big cost. The big benefit is that Slobodka, I can't say for sure, but it seems that Slobodka produced the largest percentage of Gedolim of the next generations. So, in my Rosh Hashiva's class, so to speak, you had Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Reuven Gerzovsky, Rav Yitzchak Huttner. At least in America, these were like the Gedolei Hador. Slobodka produced all of these great, great Gedolim. On the other hand, Slobodka did produce its share of Apikorsim, of people who became very, very great and very, very famous, but because they were encouraged to develop in their own individual way, some of them rebelled against Torah. See, in Kelim, you didn't really have anyone who went off the derech. The chinuch in Kelim was such that, you became a Kelim person. But in Slobodka, the emphasis on godless Adam created a certain independence of spirit. So that could lead to a person becoming a gadol, and that could lead to a person becoming a gadol in another area. A very outstanding example. You may not have heard of him, but he was a very, very esteemed scholar. Was Harry Wolfson. Harry Wolfson, who died, I think, like 1970, Harry Wolfson was a Talmud of Slobodka. He was a Talmud of Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka, and he eventually became totally not religious. He became a scholar of philosophy and the first Jewish professor at Harvard. And what's interesting is, it's amazing. He just took the model of the yeshiva and he applied it to philosophy, meaning he never got married. He would sit in his room in Harvard, 15 hours a day, being Jewish, v'chaiker, philosophical texts. Many of them were Jewish philosophy, as a matter of fact, but he did other philosophy as well. I mean, his favorite was Spinoza, who, Spinoza happens to be Jewish, but Spinoza was
the classical definition of an apikoros, and the like. And Wolfson credits his derech in philosophy to the derech halimer that he picked up in Slovakia. He says that in the first. And by the way, you can actually find this in the Yor Sameach main office. I don't know if anyone ever noticed this. In the Yor Sameach office, there's like a picture of a page of Gemara which describes Talmudic learning. And if you look, there's a Rashi equivalent and a Tosos equivalent. So now you'll be able to make sense of this. If you look at, I think, the Rashi, I'm not sure, one of them in the middle, but it tells you, you will notice a beautiful description of Talmudic learning from Harry Ostrin Wolfson. You'll see it. He is the author of that quote. And he wrote that in the introduction to one of his philosophical works, in which he says the way he approaches philosophy is the way Talmudic scholars approach Talmud, and he then described it. He was a very, very talented person, but totally not religious. Saif Yamav, you know, he regretted. Okay, but be it as it may, that was Slobodka. So Kelem emphasized self-control, self-mastery, and Slobodka emphasized godless adam and finding your inner gifts and your inner kochos, and build on your kochos. The altar, by the way, what was the altar's job in Slobodka? It's very, very interesting. The altar had no official job. Had no official job in Slobodka. He was not the Rosh Hashiva of Slobodka. There were other people who were the Rosh Hashiva of Slobodka. He was not a Magichir. He was not even the Mashgiach of Slobodka. Somebody else was Mashgiach. He had no job at all. He had founded the place, but he had no job. It's not clear he got any money from the yeshiva at all. In fact, his mishpacha lived in Kelem, which he would go back for Yom Tov, I mentioned for Elul. And in fact, he never asserted, when he would tell people things, he would never say, I say, he would always say, the minhag of the yeshiva, there was always the minhag of the yeshiva, which he made all the minhagim of the yeshiva. But he was also an amazing person. People like Rav Yaakov, like my Rosh Hashiva, they felt like his children. There were times in which if he loved you and he thought you had potential, he would give you very, very stark mussar. But if he felt that you really didn't have such great potential, he kind of left you alone. So, and sometimes that was the greatest tochecha of all, is when you came late to Seder and he didn't say anything. Because that meant he was really saying, you're not a person that a lot of good things can come from. And that hurt people. That was the greatest mussar of all. So people would come to him and say, Rebbe, I don't know if the Rebbe saw, I was a half an hour late today. And he would say, that's fine. That was turning the knife, you know. So he had all sorts of ways of giving people mussar. Even the aliyahs were a very big deal in Slobodka. Every day, every week, he determined who got the Shabbos aliyahs. So, obviously the hierarchy is, after Kohen Levi, Shlishi and Shishi are the Choshev aliyahs, and the other aliyahs are less, Revi. Again, all those interesting, I want to tell you a little aside. In the yeshivisha hierarchy, Revi is the least esteemed aliyah. But I want you to know that the Rush, one of the Gedolei Rishonim, insisted he be given Revi every Shabbos. Because Chas V'Shalom, for anybody to ever assume that any Aliyah to the Torah is not a great, great Kavod. But that's 100% true. But Lamaisa, the reality is every Aliyah is a tremendous honor. And one should be privileged to have it. But Lamaisa, it happens to be in the yeshiva world, there's a certain hierarchy of aliyahs. Not that it should be, but it is. And in Slobodka, they practice it. So if a bachur got revi any given week, that was a shtickle bit of a sign that the altar had tainus on it. Even little symbols like that. So a person once got revi, a very chashuv person once got revi, and he went to the altar afterwards and said, what did I do wrong? And the altar said, Don't you remember what you did 10 years ago? You didn't want to bring it up for 10 years because you thought the person wasn't ready. But what did you do 10 years ago? So listen to this, that somebody came into Shul Shabbos morning, and he was in a rush and he wasn't thinking, and he took off his jacket and rolled off his sleeve, like you're putting on tefillin. Meaning a person would say, you run in. And the altar said, and you saw that, and I noticed that you cracked a smile. Don't you know what Chazal say when you get pleasure in somebody else's embarrassment? The altar remembered that for 10 years. That's why this guy got with me. Whatever, all sorts of vinyanim, like mischabed b'kol chavero, that means getting nachas, getting pleasure in somebody's embarrassment. You know, he smiled when he rolled up his sleeve. So that was the altar of Slobodka. Now let me mention the third Talmud, who's also very, very young. In fact, he was also mainly a Talmud of the altar of Kelim, but he was zeicha to learn with Rabbi Yisrael. This is the altar of Nevardik. Now the altar of Nevardik is in some ways the strangest, the most extreme. The altar of Nevardik was a yasim. Again, he was a very, very brilliant Eloi, a big Talmud Chacham, but he lost his parents at a young age, like 15 or so, and he had a lot of children. He got married young as well, and as a result, he had to be involved in Parnassa. He was making he was working. He was working. And he met Rabbi Saul Salanter as a working man, as a balabas. And Rabbi Saul Salanter says, what do you do with your time? So he says, I have to make a living. So his Salanter said to him, you're thinking about living, aren't you? You should also be thinking about dying. I mean, you should be thinking about, after Me'ev Yesrim Shana, what are you going to give to Hashem? And obviously I'm not doing it justice, but apparently the way Rabbi Yisrael said it had such a hashpa on the altar of Nevardik that in the middle of the working day, he just let go of his horses and everything else, and he devoted himself to Limud HaTorah in a very extreme way. And at some point, this is really the most strange thing, at some point he decided he wanted to be closeted out. This is, I think, after his wife died. His wife died shortly thereafter. So he was an alman. What he did was he decided to wall himself in a house. I mean, imagine this. It's like, take a house, put bricks in the doorway. You can't leave the house. And there were two holes in the wall so people could bring him food. He arranged. One was for milchik food, one was for fleshik food, but he was called Rav Yezel. Rav Yosef Yezel is a Yiddish of Yosef. Baal HaChorin, the master of the holes. One was milchik, one was fleshik. And he stayed in solitary confinement in that place for around 2.5 years. Now, some people were enraged. Some people thought he was absolutely crazy. The Rav of Nevardik at the time was a very, very great gadol, the Aruch HaShulchan. And people went to the Aruch HaShulchan and said, this guy is nuts, let's tear down the house. The Aruch HaShulchan said, Rav Yisrael is a tzaddik. I don't understand his ways. You don't understand his ways, but he's a tzaddik. And apparently, he was in this solitary confinement for 2 years. But after those 2 years were up, imagine the energy that he had pent up, he then started establishing yeshivas like crazy all over Poland. He established 120 yeshivas. The Steipler learned in a Nevardik yeshiva, and the Steipler became a Rosh Yeshiva of Nevardik before he came to Eretz Yisrael. Right? And what was Nevardik about? Nevardik was about emunah in Hashem, and that one's emunah has to be so great that no matter how impossible something seems, you just ask yourself, you never ask yourself the question, is it possible to do this? You just ask yourself the question, is this something that should be done? If the answer is yes, I will do it, or I will try to do it, even if there's a million to one chance it's going to flop. I mean, I should add, the 120 yeshivas that were established were in Stalinist Russia. He was establishing yeshivas under the noses of Stalin, where opening a yeshiva would be a death sentence or a life sentence in Siberia, which was the same as a death sentence. They had unquestionable, phenomenal emuna. And because of this, he had a lot of unconventional educational techniques. One of his unconventional educational techniques, he wanted it, because he said, a lot of the times that people are reluctant to do something is they're embarrassed. I don't want to do something because I'm embarrassed. People will look at me funny. So he was mechanech his talmidim not to be embarrassed. So they say one of the exercises would be that a talmid would have to go to a food store and ask for shoes, or go into a, whatever it is, go into a bakery and ask for a hammer. And they would say, well, this is a bakery. What's the matter with you? And you know, they would kind of laugh at you. But you learned not to be ashamed. Again, you could argue on all these things. Isn't it a chilul Hashem? Okay, you know, there are a lot of things you could argue about this. But he wanted his talmidim to have no pachad, no mora, no fear, no embarrassment. The Ramuna and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to be so absolute. Now, I want to point out, the Chazon Ish wrote a very, very beautiful sefer on Inyanim of Emuna and Bitachon. Maybe you've seen it. And that sefer was heavily censored, actually. In other words, after his death, they took things out. Recently, they published... People who publish Svarim take things out all the time. Yeah. I don't mean the Christians. No. We don't have Christian censorship anymore. But the censorship that goes on today is by front, very front people. They often take things out that are considered controversial.
Yes, they do.
They do. They actually do it often. More often than they should. Yeah, for sure. But the point I want to make is that the Chazon Ish has a very famous discussion of what is emunah or bitachon. And he says, it doesn't mean Hashem will give you. In other words, some people think bitachon means if I pray to Hashem with the right kavanah, Hashem will definitely give me what I want. And if I don't get what I want, it's because I didn't have enough bitachon. There's such a shita. The Chazon Ish strongly, strongly argues with that shita. Because the Chazon Ish says sometimes Hashem will not give you what you want. Bitachon just means whatever happens in my life comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I know it's l'tov, but it doesn't mean if I only pray hard enough, I'm going to get what I want. The truth of the matter is, the Chazon Ish is actually engaging in a criticism of the Shita of Nevardik. Because the way the Chazon Ish understood Nevardik had a Shita of Emunah, that if you're mechaven l'shem shemayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give you what you want. The Chazon Ish says that's not emes. And he felt that Nevardik sometimes were putting themselves in a makom sakana. They were going to dangerous places because they said, Hashem's going to protect me. And the Chazon Ish argued that based on teachings of Chazal, even shiluchei mitzvah who don't get hurt, but if you go to a place that is shechiyah chazek, the Gemara says, a place that is very dangerous, there's no guarantee. Right? So the Chazon Ish doesn't mention Nevardik, but the emes is, especially in the part that was censored, if you look at the restored passages, he is actually engaged in a discussion against the Nevardik Ashita. But I'll tell you one maysa about a Talmud of a Talmud of Nevardik. Rav Gershon Liebman was a Chashuv Rosh Yeshiva of the Nevardik Yeshiva in Paris. And he used to come to America to collect money for the yeshiva. But two things about him that are funny. One thing that are funny is he couldn't stand the sight of money. Money represented Gashmias. Money represented Taiva. Money represented too much involvement in Olam Hazeh. So when he saw money, he vomited. He literally got physically sick when he saw money. So there always had to be somebody. He always had to go with somebody to take the checks or take the money because Rav Gershon Liebman could not look at money. That was kind of a Nevardik kind of midah, in which money itself, although you needed it, but money itself was a repulsive thing. So as a result, He never came to America with any money in his pocket. I mean, imagine this. He comes from Europe to the United States. He doesn't have, I mean, he has no French currency. He has no American currency. He doesn't have a nickel in his pocket. How is he going to go anywhere? He sure doesn't have a credit card, that's for sure. So he's in the airport. One of his former talmidim happens to be in the airport picking up somebody from Israel. He says, Rosh Yeshiva, what is the chus to see you? Can I take you somewhere? He says, oh yes, I have to go to Manhattan. Baruch Hashem. So as they're driving, you know, the Talmud didn't want to pry, but the Talmud at some point says, you know, Rebbe, Baruch Hashem, I have this chus of taking you. I'm just wondering, you know, what would have been if I wouldn't have been at the airport? Like, what would have happened? So the Rashiva said, you were there, weren't you? In other words, Navardik worked with that type of cheshbon, that I have emuna. I'm doing the Ratzon HaBayrei, I'm doing a mitzvah, it's going to work out. Again, this is what the Chazon Ish was a little critical in terms of not making reasonable hishtadlus. Right? So we have, so the Kitzer, just to summarize this, we have these three outgrowths of Rabbi Yisrael. We have discipline, calmness, and organization, which is Kelim. We have the greatness of the human potential, which is Slobodka. And then we have the bedrock emuna in the Bayrei, that comes from the Vardik. The Alter of Vardik wrote a sefer. Some of you guys I see learn it. Madrega Sadam is the Alter of the Vardik's sefer on Emuna. But sometimes if you know a little bit of the stories, that can give you more of a sense of that how much he lived that cheek. Now, there were other Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael who did not have yeshivas per se, but they were very, very important presences. In fact, they tended to hang around Slobodka. And they tended to kind of be connected to Slobodka in a very informal way. One was Rav Yitzchak Blazer, who was known as Rav Itzel Petterberger, because he was the Rav of Petersburg at one time in his life. And the other was Rav Naftali Amsterdam. So they were great, great, great tzaddikim. They didn't have yeshivas, they didn't have talmidim. Dr. Witzel Petterberger was one of the great rabbanim of the generation, but he left the rabbanim just to become like a kailo guy in Slobodka. And B'Seif Yamav, he lived in Gula. He lived in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Witzel Petterberger, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer is the name. And Rabbi Natali Amsterdam was the Rav in an odd place, Helsinki, Finland. But he didn't want rabbanis either. And he became a baker in Slobodka. He was a baker of bread. But he was also one of the great informal kochas. You had like older, great people who would hang around the yeshiva and be a hashpa on the bachrim. And it says that he always had a bachar in Slobodka with whom he would make a seder in Ketzos HaChoshen. That's what he liked. He wanted to learn with the bachrim. And that was his limit. So just to give you a little sense of all the zinyanim, and although this is a bit of a digression from our normal limud, but the point is that all of this is really from, this is Litvish, this is all from the Vilna Gaon, and it's interesting that the very first sefer, when the Gro was Nifter, the very, very first sefer of the Vilna Gaon's writings that was published after his death was his Perish on Mishlei, as opposed to the more lumbish of things, because once again, as Shlomo HaMelech says, Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem, the beginning of wisdom is Yiras Hashem. And this is the Sefer of Yiras Hashem. And that's how important the idea of Musar and Midos was. So the point is, we still have Musar Yeshivas, but they're really a very, very, very pale imitation of that. You know, Navardik is certainly not, it's not Navardik. And Kelim there actually isn't. One final mice, I'll leave you about Kelim. One of the last great Kelimers, by the way, the name Kelimer just means from Kelim, that's exactly it, was Rav Elia Lapian. Rav Elia Lapian, it was probably Nifter 30 years ago. So I'll tell you a little story that Baruch Hashem, he was Zochet Arichas Yamim. He was Nifter well into his 90s. And the story goes, and we've all been there, he was waiting for a bus, and the bus was late. and he was learning a Mishnayos. He was learning Mishnayos. And after 25 minutes past the expected time, he looks up from the Mishnayos to see if the bus is coming. Then he immediately starts crying, and he says, I see that I've lost all of the milas that I worked on from the time I was a bacher. In Kelim, well, you never looked up. As I mentioned before, what are you looking up for? But when the bus comes, you'll know. Like, what exactly, this is the kind of derisha they made on themselves. What exactly is the purpose of my looking up? I'm curious. I can learn until the bus comes. When the bus comes, I'll go on the bus. So he was crying that after 25 minutes, he had this Yetzer Hara, that he had to look at the bus, right? That was the hanhaga of those Gedolei Himmels. Okay, stop here. Have a good week. And,
someone cracked them now to wait for the place for the bus. They must have been tracked by. You have to flag the driver.
That's true. That's true. You're exactly right. You're right. I had that with the bus stop. They don't stop at stops now. I was very surprised. Yeah, I mean, I pushed the button, and the guy didn't stop. He says, because there was nobody. I don't know. He says, I always figured to stop at every stop. I thought that's how a bus works. Or Sameach itself as a yeshiva?
Yeah, like which limud?
It's probably closer to Slobodka in some ways. The middle one.
So Sabatka was they emphasized Yira or Emuna or
no? They emphasized the greatness of a human potential. Yeah.
And that's where that's the issue of where there was a golem went and people were
yes.
Hoping there.
Yes. 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 But the truth is, today things are a combination a little bit. I don't think you can call them the pure types.
But that's the issue of where. You get the best going and come out of it because it gives you independence.
It gives people independence, yeah. But as I say, all the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael have undergone some modification. So, you know, when I tell you this is, you know, I give you three types, you know, one, two, three, but everything is a mixture of everything. So you don't have the pure.
And somehow it all connects to Vilna Gaon because it's...
Well, because remember that all the yeshivas are from the Volozhin yeshiva. Volozhin is called the mother of yeshivas. Volozhin closed in 1890s. But Slobodka, Mir, Panovich, Telz, all of these are outgrowths of the Volozhin yeshiva, which was founded by the student of the Vilna Gaon. So all of the great yeshivas are from Volozhin.
But it looks like all these things, they're like Musar side of the yeshiva, because Gemara, it's like, there's one way to learn Gemara, but then there's the Musar, so that they only differ on the Musar part, but the Gemara, or did they also differ on the limit of Gemara Musar? Or did they learn Musar from Gemara, and that's the way they brought it down?
Well, most of the Gemara learning was much the same, the truth of the matter is, because Volozhin established a certain pattern of learning.
So how much time did they dedicate towards Musar? Because
if they had these results,
it must have been like a significant allocation of time, maybe like at least a quarter of the day towards Musar.
No, it was not that much. It was not that much. It was absolutely not that much.
How much?
In the Hasidic yeshivas, like in a Chabad yeshiva, they would spend 3 hours a day on Hasidus. In a Musar yeshiva, it would be maybe at most an hour. Maybe Chutz L'Shtarim, but they would not. They certainly had three full.
So they didn't differ that much because most of the time it was Gemara and it was very similar. You just on the Musar part, they would emphasize.
That's correct. It was not like a Chassidish yeshiva that had so many hours on Chassidus. Yeah.
Just
a few thoughts
on that. Fresh Chaim Lomnitz got something that comes from. Some people hold that comes from not having good tafkin. It's possible it had a chemical imbalance.
You know, it is possible. I don't have a psychological profile of Phil Slanka. It is recorded. You know, the old word for term for depression is mara shechora. And in those days, they were not so psychologically attuned to biochemical imbalance. So they said maybe he was frustrated because he wasn't able to accomplish all he wanted to accomplish. But it could have been a biochemical imbalance, you know. It could have been Prozac, whatever it would be. But the point basically was that he did not let it stop him. That's an amazing thing. He was just misgabber over that. You know?
Is there such a thing as depression from a chemical imbalance?
Yeah, of course there is. Of course there is. Absolutely.
Everything going for you, but for some reason.
Absolutely. We don't deny. We don't deny chemical imbalances. There's a refu, you know, chalvi
hanefesh.
People
say that it means there's something lacking in their bone, and that someone.
Well, I mean, lavdafka. I mean, sometimes medication can bring you to a level of normalcy where you're then able to work on your ruchniyistika problems. Yeah, there probably are ruchniyistika problems in all depression, but you first have to deal with the machala too. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. And then you can work on yourself, whatever you need to work on. Sure. Okay, have a good day.